The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Are you unhappy with your health and catch everything doing the rounds? Do you have a mystery illness the doctors can't treat? Are you searching for a better way to manage your health? My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session. For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
Hello and welcome to this week's Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life that helps people with cancer understand and take advantage of integrative medicine to aid their recovery. This week, I'm talking to a functionally trained nutritional therapist. And if you're not sure what all that means, then do keep listening. I'm talking to Mark Bennett about his approach to supporting people through treatment and after using a range of nutritional methods and about progress with integration in the UK. I'm speaking to Mark over Skype at his practice near Newbury, west of London. Hi Mark, thank you very much indeed for coming on the Yes to Life show today.
Hello Robin, yeah, no, my pleasure indeed. Very happy to be here. Thank you.
Great. So people with cancer asking about things they can do to help themselves, they're often told by their oncologist that it generally doesn't matter what they eat. In fact, one of our top cancer centres exhorts people with cancer to eat sugar, honey, syrup, treacle and sugary foods such as chocolate, cakes and sweets, as these are good sources of energy. And of course, they usually tell their patients to avoid any supplements during treatment. The message generally is that oncologists are the only people able to do anything to affect the present or future health of the people with cancer. And so they advise them to keep away from the internet, do their best to enjoy their life and hope for the best. So what do you make of this advice?
Well, I mean, that advice is fundamentally flawed on many, many different aspects. So, I mean, there's so many issues with that sort of what you just stated that it's difficult to know where to start. I mean, let's start with the concept that diet has absolutely no impact on the outcome of cancer. I mean, I genuinely am amazed at that statement. When one considers just how fundamental food is in terms of well-being, I just cannot understand how anybody can make that statement, yet alone actually suggest that the patient, the client, actually consumes high sugar foods in order to increase energy levels. I just find that in this day and age, given what we know, I find that actually quite incredible. In fact, I would say it's negligent to actually talk like that. Now, the issue here is that, you know, from my perspective as a nutritional therapist, which essentially is a nutritional scientist working in clinical practice with chronically ill people, and my average client is chronically ill, and cancer obviously is included in that bracket. Mm-hmm. It is truly incredible what happens when one changes diet in an appropriate way for the client. And I mean, I've got hundreds of case reports of people achieving unbelievable gains in their well-being. And in fact, actually completely controlling conditions that technically speaking are not possible to control using diet alone. I mean, diet alone is probably the fundamental, most important factor when it comes to controlling chronic disease. Now, food is the most powerful medicine known to humankind. You know, that's not my words. Those are words of people that are far more intelligent and capable than I am. So food is a medicine, but it also can be a poison. And this is the really key point here. One person's meat is another person's poison. And when people ask me questions about, well, whether I should eat dairy or not, well, I mean, you just don't know the answer to that, because for some people dairy is fantastic, for other people it is literally awful, and it also depends on the type of dairy you're consuming. So this subject is very complex. But going back to the main point about food and its potential medicinal properties, you know, food is nutrigenomics. Is the science of how nutrients literally turn on or off genes. You know, no pharmaceutical agent can do that. Food does do it. So there are lots of examples where food can absolutely, and that's what I use in my clinic on a daily basis, is appropriate personalized food choices to drive people towards their health goals. So do you want me to, I mean, I can move on to the next point, or do you want to come back at me on that subject?
Well, look, yeah, we're going to go into all those things. So it's really good to get your first off hit, basically, of where you're coming from in terms of where you think food stands in relation to cancer. That's really great. And we're going to go into loads of detail, I can assure you. So,
yeah, okay.
You talk a bit on your website about functional medicine, and in recent years, this has been making major inroads into the world's both nutritional therapy and increasing with GPs. It's fast becoming a sort of bridge between these two, which were up until recently thoroughly disconnected disciplines. So can you say why that you think functional medicine has been so influential in changing the way that practitioners are working?
Well, at the end of the day, when one is presenting with a chronic condition, cancer, dementia, cardiovascular disease, whatever it is, yes, you can use drugs to treat symptoms, but of course that's all the drugs do, is they treat symptoms. So they are just a short-term solution, potentially a short-term solution to an acute situation in terms of the symptoms that the client's presenting with. Surely it makes more sense to look at causation. Why does somebody actually end up developing cancer, for example? You know, we know that there are multiple reasons as to why cancer develops, and it's working out what is driving this condition. So in the functional model, this is the basis of what we call, or this is based on the fact of what we call triggers and mediators, what initiates the problem and what perpetuates the problem. Mm-hmm. And of course, the functional model is based on the premise that the body consists of multiple interconnected, sophisticated systems, and everything connects with everything else. It's a cat's cradle of connections. And if one can identify where the functional imbalances are, then you have a much greater chance of being able to potentially help resolve or even cure the condition that individual is presenting with. And not only that, you can actually resolve multiple issues at the same time.
Mm, right. That's always been a kind of target for derision from orthodox medicine, the idea that several things get fixed at once by one treatment. That just isn't in their lexicon, really. Just not supposed to happen.
No, indeed. But it does. I mean, Robin, it does. I mean, that is exactly the point. It's about, you know, when I'm working with clients with a whole range of chronic conditions, we always start with the gut. The gut is literally the foundation upon which your health is built. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of my clients, no matter what they're presenting with, will have digestive dysfunction. You know, their digestive system will not be optimal. Mm-hmm. So there may be small degrees of digestive instability, or there may be significant degrees of digestive instability. And in fact, even if you don't present with digestive instability or dysfunction, that does not mean that everything is perfect in terms of the digestive system, but all roads of health, literally, the more I do what I do, the more I read about the subject of what I do, all roads of health lead to the gut. I genuinely believe that is the case. And no matter what we're dealing with, we start with that system, because you then build, if you can get that system right and functioning properly, I mean, it's not just about digestion, it's about absorption. You know, people say you are what you eat. Yes, to an extent you are, but to be more correct about it, you are what you absorb. Hmm. So we know that cells require approximately 250 different micronutrients to function properly. You know, we're a collection of 36 trillion cells in the body, organized into different organs. Those cells don't malfunction for many reasons. There's very few reasons, actually, why cells actually malfunction. And of course, when cells malfunction, we end up with disease. And one of the key reasons is that the cells are just not getting the nutrients they require. And those nutrients have got to come from somewhere. You've got to eat them, but you've also got to efficiently and effectively digest them and absorb them. And that is often the biggest issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so two interesting things there. I mean, one is to note that actually Orthodox medicine seems to have woken up to the same message that you were just touting there about the centrality or the importance of the gut. This seems to be coming into Orthodox medicine now, and some of the latest research is finding out just what the difference is between the results of treating someone who's got a healthy gut and somebody who hasn't, being very different. And so that's hopeful. I'm just also interested to ask, you say that the people who arrive in the main, they don't have optimal digestion. Well, what do you put it down to? What are the things that are creating the situation?
Well, I mean, this comes back down to the good old microflora, the microbiome, the microflora. It's got many words, but this is the cacophony of bacteria that exists within our digestive systems, which equates to about 100 trillion bacteria, weighing up just over 2 kilos in the average adult. And what we know is that when the microflora are out of balance, then a lot of things are out of balance in the digestive system. But it's not just the microflora. But sorry, let's rewind. Why does that happen? Why do we get imbalances in the digestive system? Why do we get digestive instability? Well, it can be also, it can be absolutely created by environment and lifestyle triggers. So how you were born, the state of the microflora of your mother that was handed to you, whether you were born through C-section or naturally, this is the heirloom that is handed down from your mother, the inoculation of her microflora when you're born through the natural process, okay? Whether you were breastfed, the colostrum, the milk, that the breast milk, as opposed to bottle fed, how you were fed when you were weaned, the toxic load you were exposed to, all kinds of things, stress, the environment you're in, the toxins that are there, all these things make a massive difference to how you are in terms of your balance, your bacterial species, which ultimately then could potentially lead to digestive dysfunction. So what we know is that when we use sophisticated stool tests, genetic tests that actually measure imbalances in the bacterial species of digestive systems, when people are presenting with these digestive dysfunctions, then often they have considerable imbalances going on in their microflora species. So they may have, for example, elevated levels of Helicobacter pylori in the stomach, or they may have certain amoebic parasites, or they may have low levels of beneficial flora, or they may have suboptimal stomach acid, or they may have suboptimal bile flow. The list goes on. So by doing that sort of test, you can actually gain a lot of information about where the potential problems are, and importantly, be able to actually intervene in an intelligent and very precise way.
Very interesting. So obviously we're in the midst of an epidemic of chronic conditions. So given that the foundational role that you've placed upon the gut flora, would you connect those two things?
Absolutely, fundamentally, yes. What has taken effectively 2.5 million years to evolve, we are rapidly unwinding, I would argue, rapidly unwinding in a matter of several decades.
Through lifestyle. So this is things like antibiotics and chemicals being ingested.
Yeah, antibiotics is one thing. I mean, I know antibiotics are essential in certain situations. I'm not mocking that. But what I'm saying is we've overused them. And, they're in our food supply. The majority of antibiotic consumption comes through food. Is ludicrous. Now, there is also the toxin thing is a huge subject. 85,000 chemicals released into the environment since the end of the Second World War. No one's done any research on what impact it has on us. What about glyphosate? Is glyphosate all right or is it not all right? Well, that's a huge topic. We could probably talk about that for 3 hours. But to be honest with you, that's just one example. What about the paints in your house? What about the varnishes used on the floor? What about the air fresheners? What about toothpaste? What about perfumes? What about aftershave? I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Seriously, this stuff is a huge subject. What you put in your dishwasher also matters. How you wash your plates. These things all matter. Your drinking water. Is it all right to just drink tap water? I would argue no. So, okay, you can turn yourself into a little bit of a crazy situation by thinking about this too much because you become obsessed with it, and of course then it becomes a stressor in its own right. But what I'm saying is you can make sensible decisions about what you do in order to actually reduce the load. Right. And this is the point. We are more in control than anybody would ever lead you to believe. You are far more in control of your health and your well-being than anybody would ever lead you to believe, which is really going back to your first comment about, well, just keep eating everything and just hope that everything's all right, is fundamentally at odds with that.
Right, right. Okay, so despite the advice which I outlined at the beginning, increasingly more people with cancer are looking beyond their oncology team for support. Do you find yourself supporting a lot of people with cancer?
I wouldn't say a lot. I certainly have a handful of active cancer patients at the moment who, and also post-cancer survivors as well. That's interesting. There's quite a distinct set of people who have gone through the cancer process and successfully managed to control it,
yes,
often using modern medicine, but are shunning the modern medical drugs, for example, to use with breast cancer. So things like tamoxifen to reduce estrogen levels in the body and reduce the chances of it recurring. So, yes, there are a handful of clients I'm working with on an active basis. I mean, that also ranges right through to stage four brain cancer clients, who literally, where modern medicine has said there is nothing more we can do.
Right.
So there is a whole raft of individuals I have the privilege of working with.
Mm. Okay. Great. Well, I'd like to talk about some of those scenarios a bit later on as well. There's different scenarios because, they're very different places that people are in. So I know you're an ardent advocate of integrative medicine, of using things like functional medicine, nutritional medicine, lifestyle medicine together with conventional treatment. So
yes,
I wanted to ask why you're so enthusiastic about integration and what you think it has to offer over and above either conventional approaches alone or indeed unconventional approaches alone.
Right. That's a really important point, that last statement you make. I would never sit in my clinic and suggest to a client that they ignored their oncologist from the point of view using chemotherapy, radiotherapy, or surgery. That is just not where I come from. There is a place for every single treatment, but the key point here is it's the integration of those treatments that will ultimately give the client the best possible chance of getting in control of these things. So if one, these are complex conditions, these are not simplistic conditions. Often in medicine, we simplify things. We say that cholesterol, for example, causes cardiovascular disease. It's not as simple as that.
Right.
And so when it comes to cancer, which is a multifactorial, complex condition, and the reasons why somebody develops cancer, a particular type of cancer, may be completely different to why somebody else develops it. So you cannot just have one size fits all. That is missing chances to actually get people well. You could easily get people falling between the stools, which often happens, and that's not good enough. Why don't we integrate it? Why don't we make life better for the client from the point of view of not getting them to decide, do I go complement? Well, alternative actually is what they're suggesting, because alternative implies you do nothing else, you just go an alternative route.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you go complementary, which is the important differentiating, the definition of complementary approach is you complement the other modalities that have been used. So we know that in the Far East, they've used, for example, mycotherapy, mushroom therapy. They integrate it into cancer treatment. That's been done for an awfully long time.
Right.
If you've got complex metabolic conditions, why would you not use a silver buckshot approach as opposed to a silver bullet approach? Those are the words of Professor Bredesen, Dale Bredesen, and he's talking specifically about Alzheimer's and dementia. He uses this silver buckshot analogy as opposed to a silver bullet. It makes logical sense.
Right.
Marginal gains. Think about the Sky cycling team. Marginal gains was basically what made them great. This was about lots of little things joining together to allow actually the cyclist to be dominant in that particular sport. It worked. So the same approach applies to human health and well-being. It is about what you eat, your toxic load, your viral load. It is about the balance of the bacterial species. Have you got parasites? It is about how stressed you are, how you manage stress, whether you actually need to leap into a cold shower to potentially, get the benefits from and the biochemical benefits that come from going exposure into cold water. The list goes on, Robin. Honestly, we could talk for hours about that subject alone, but absolutely Does integration work, or is it a more sensible approach to these chronic conditions? Categorically, yes.
Good. Well, of course, I'm right with you on that. Yes, life's all about integrative medicine. And I love the analogy you've made there of just adding in all these little strands, because every little bit helps and gives you better odds, better chances, probably better quality of life, and better long-term expectancy. So, yeah, I completely agree. Why not add those things in? And that sort of why not question is the thing which is missing all too often, unfortunately, in oncology wards around the country. It's like no is much easier than why not. And that's what people are getting. So, you know, we are desperately in need of some new attitudes in this country in order to catch up with the benefits that patients are receiving in some other countries from actually embracing the why not principle.
Absolutely, totally and utterly. Mm. I mean, if you take a classic example of issues in terms of weaving in a particular approach, a mycotherapy mushroom approach, for example, with cancer. I mean, I use this a lot with my autoimmune clients as well. Mm-hmm. But specifically with oncological clients or cancer clients, often the oncologist will say, I'm just not interested in you taking anything else whilst you undertake the chemotherapy protocol, for example. Yeah. Now, I totally understand the logic behind why the oncologist may say that. But to be absolutely fair to that particular statement, often when you start putting in things like turmeric and other natural supplements, it can absolutely have an impact on how these chemotherapy agents are physically detoxified from the body. And of course, that upsets a very finely tuned mechanism. You know, so if you excrete the chemotherapy agent too fast, then of course it doesn't have the ability to do its job properly. But also, conversely, if you actually slow the excretion process or detoxification process down, then you potentially could make the situation very dangerous for the client. So
right.
I totally understand the logic. You know, I'm not belittling that at all. But what I do struggle with is the fact that we get this blanket no. So if you take things like mycotherapy, and we talk about Hifastaterra, this company in northwest Spain, which I'm working with, and this is an incredible business because, you know, one of their key rationales for being is to actually create oncological treatments that are complementary to modern medicine. They've got the science that shows that actually the mushrooms are detoxified in through other pathways than the cytochrome P450 pathway, which is typically used to detoxify the chemotherapy agent. So there is no inappropriate disruption of how those chemotherapy agents are physically detoxified. So there is no rational reason why you should not use mycotherapy alongside chemotherapy, for example, especially when you start looking at the data, the science. And this is the important point, is that this company is highly scientific. You know, there's lots of medical doctors and PhD biologists working out there getting the data on the use of these particular products. And, you know, the studies show and the historic studies show that actually combining mycotherapy with chemotherapy can actually improve patient survival rate by up to between 7% and 9%. You know, that's not insignificant.
No. No, and of course, if that was a drug, they probably would be doing it. So it's much more, it's a kind of, it's an emotional thing, this, between, I think, natural medicine and, you know, pharmaceutical medicine. The divide is a bit like, you know, the divide that happens in so many walks of life. People take sides and they actually don't know anything about the other side, but they think their own side is fantastic, you know. And, well, unfortunately, the person who suffers is the person who's got cancer at the other end. They don't get the benefit of these two joining forces to help each other. So, yeah, I hear very much what you're saying. I'm a huge fan of mycotherapy and mushrooms. I think they've got an enormous amount to offer to people with cancer. In fact, all sorts of illnesses, but particularly people with cancer where, you know, help is so desperately needed.
Yes.
All right, so let's have a little scenario here. I'm was diagnosed a few weeks ago with prostate cancer. I've been started on hormone therapy. I might be having radiotherapy or surgery in the near future, and I ring you up and come for my first appointment. What would you do? What do you have on offer for me?
Well, the first thing I would do is we would assess you from a functional perspective. So the first thing I would ask you to do is to complete a detailed health questionnaire, which will basically ask you questions about how you were born, family history of diseases, all kinds of aspects of diet, what you consume both food and drink wise, symptoms, and these symptoms are carefully labeled or aggregated together in to specify certain sort of key functional systems within the body. Mm-hmm. The client literally completes that and puts as much historic information down as possible, and you know, often clients will, and I completely understand why, they will sort of omit things because they think it's not relevant. Like, for example, having tonsillitis, you know, as a child, or glue ear or something along those lines. But I understand why that happens, but that's the whole point. We the client starts off by filling the form up, and then what we do is we use that as the basis for the first consultation. That is where we sit down and we get to know each other. And I start to work through the information that we've got already on you, and I use the time to explain the scientific rationale behind what might be going on in terms of functional and imbalances that may have contributed to where you are currently today with prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. So by doing that, the client then begins to understand that actually there's lots of biochemical reasons as to why you may have systems that are imbalanced. And okay, we always start with the gut. So I would then possibly suggest, depending on the client's ability to finance this, I mean, we don't always do it because not everybody can justify it, but if we can start to do some functional tests to actually provide real data, you know, I'm a scientist, I like data, I don't like guessing things. Obviously in the real world, that's not always possible, but if we can do it, we try and do it. And we will agree a testing plan to use functional tests. These are tests that are typically not provided through the standard medical treatments that we are offered today through the NHS. And these are tests that I will access with various labs across the world that I respect enormously. And these are tests that will provide us with hopefully a lot of additional data on how, for example, the digestive system is working. What about nutrient status? You know, have you got enough magnesium and zinc? You know, zinc is fundamental to immune function. So if you think about cancer, you know, how is the immune system working? Zinc is fundamental to prostate health. You know, we can instantly start to connect things together. So, you know, zinc, B vitamins, your vitamin A, your antioxidant status, your liver health, you know, the list goes on. We do an extended health risk profile. It's then looking at absorption capacity, because obviously if there are imbalances in nutrients, you know, i.e. you're low in nutrients when you're actually eating a broad diet, then you have to question why. So what about small intestinal bacteria overgrowth? How is the digestive system functioning, as we talked about? You know, you may then start looking at the integrity of the gut lining. You know, histamine is often involved, and histamine and small intestinal bacteria overgrowth and food sensitivities, you know, we start to explore the bigger picture here. We try and get data so that what we can do is then devise a personalized plan that works alongside your modern medical interventions that you are currently going through or about to go through. And the key thing here, Robin, is that we talk to the oncologist. We make sure that nothing is done with the client that the oncologist team or the doctors don't know about. It's okay. Really important to have open, transparent communication here.
Mm-hmm. And how interested are the oncologists in your open, transparent communication?
They're not interested. Ah. And you know, that's a blanket statement. I have not yet had a single conversation, you know, directly with an oncologist about any of this stuff. It's always going through the client, and the client will always be told one thing and told to relay it to me. There is never a situation where, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm happy to talk by email, by Skype, whatever, you know, phone, whatever technique. I would love communication to be more direct. You know, let's talk about it. Let's give the client the best possible outcome by using the two modalities together, you know, to actually, you know, one-on-one creates four, Yeah. Right. That's the whole idea here, to try and actually, you know, really deliver something that's powerful to the client. So going back to your prostate cancer scenario, you know, what about using a product that's specifically designed, you know, mushroom product that's specifically designed to support cancer, prostate cancer, you know, whilst going through chemotherapy, radiotherapy treatments, actually potentially mitigating or even eliminating the side effects of these really quite significant treatments. Mm. You then end up with a win-win situation. The oncologist gets the client to actually complete the course. The client feels actually a lot more supported and actually also is in control. They actually feel like they're doing something productive towards their own well-being. That's an important point as well. Yes. Actually doing something that's going to contribute to how this comes out. You know, and actually you're enhancing, the data suggests that you actually enhance the outcome of the modern medical treatment. It's a complete no-brainer, and I am frustrated by this, Ryan.
Yeah, well, I can imagine it must be extremely frustrating doing what you're doing, but you're doing it, so that's good, and you've got to put the patient first, whatever the frustration.
Always. I mean, it doesn't matter how the client gets better. What matters is they get better. Who takes the glory is irrelevant.
Right. This is a kind of a put your finger in the air job, but how much of what you do you think is actually supporting the patient's own health and well-being, and how much is directly combating either the treatment side effects or the cancer itself?
Well, I would argue that anything that supports the patient or client's well-being will ultimately be fighting the cancer.
Right.
You know, I genuinely believe that, you know, that this is the whole functional model at work. You know, yes, you can wage war. And of course, that's the modern medical approach is, you know, we cut, you burn, we go in, we attack the tumor. But why does the tumor happen in the first place? And so it's all very well waging war with the tumor, and the tumor sort of regression is viewed as progress, you know, when it comes to cancer. But at the end of the day, why do these things often return? You know, we have to get to the bottom of why this happened in the first place. So I would argue anything that you do. So I would say, you know, finger in the air, 95% of what I do is about supporting well-being from multiple different angles. So going back to Professor Bredsen and dementia, he talks about a 36-point intervention to help arrest and reverse this condition, you know, the dementia condition.
Mm-hmm.
And he's getting, I don't know whether you know the studies on his work, but it's phenomenal what he's achieving.
I don't know.
You know, he's getting incredible. I mean, he published a paper in 2014, 110 patients, you know, moderately to severe demented patients, and he used a 36-point intervention, multifactorial approach, and he achieving like 90% success rates in arresting and even reversing the condition. This is remarkable stuff, but it's the same principle. It's
right.
The same principle to, you know, prostate cancer, colon cancer, breast cancer, any cancer. Why? Why does one develop it in the first place?
Right. Fantastic. Okay, so you sold us the whole concept, if you like, of joining up all these approaches and the result being more than the sum of the parts. Do you want to give us some of your, I mean, you've mentioned mushrooms several times. They're obviously well up there in your catalogue of great things you can do. What else?
Well, I mean, the beauty about mushrooms, of course, is that they are potent immune modulators. And as you know, the buzzword in cancer at the moment is immunotherapy.
Mm.
This is natural immunotherapy. And of course, immune system modulation, of course, is very different to immune system suppression. You know, immune system suppression is bashing something back, whereas immune system modulation is saying, well, actually, it's more adaptogenic. So what that means is if something is high, it is lowered, and if something is lower, it's raised. You know, this is incredible. This is the amazing effect that the biochemical properties of these mushrooms have on our immune system. We still don't quite understand how this physically works, you know, what actually, you know, is going on. But what we know is that it actually happens.
Mm.
So mushrooms are absolutely important, and they're important because of the key reason I go back to them is because they don't interfere with the modern medical approaches, you know, the chemotherapy in particular. There's no reason not to use them. In fact, the only reason not to use mushrooms is if you've got an allergy to mushrooms.
All right.
That is genuinely the only reason not to use them. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, not that many people have an overt allergy to mushrooms. Now, the other possible issue is if somebody's taking blood thinning medications, which sometimes happens, then they would also thin the blood. So in that case, you would actually reduce the blood thinning medication with the doctors as opposed to reducing the mushrooms. Anyway, to go back to your question about what other things one can use, well, it depends. I mean, it depends a lot on what one is dealing with. But often I will push clients toward a more ketogenic approach, you know, so i.e. a more of a high fat dietary approach. Okay. Because, you know, we know again by looking at historic data, we know about, you know, key studies that cancer cells do feed off glucose, sugar. And there is substantial evidence out there to suggest that a reduction in blood sugar levels may convey considerable health benefits to cancer patients. So, you know, this is why, going back to the opening part of this conversation, the concept that you should eat lots of cakes and pastries and all kinds of sugary foods is totally, I find, absolutely, I think it's actually negligent. It's a negligent device based on what we know. And if you look at the basic science of this, you know, glucose, essentially, if sugar is the fuel source to the cancer cells, then what actually happens is if you shut down that fuel source, you actually, the science shows, you actually improve the transportation of things like vitamin C into the cells, thereby increasing immune system's response to malignant cells and reducing the activation and inflammatory chemicals that have been shown to fuel the growth of malignant cells, okay, and reducing circulating levels of insulin and insulin growth factor 1, both of which are viewed as being growth factors from malignant cells. So that on its own, just reducing the glucose level, the sugar level in one's diet, and that's not just taking out the added sugars, that's also just looking at how you can reduce carbohydrate intake in quite a dramatic way. Now, that's something, you know, I do a lot of. So ketogenic diets, how to keep the body in a ketogenic state, which again is unique to each and every one of us. And there are tricks of the trade on how to do that using certain blood glucose and ketogenic monitors, you know, that the client can use to actually maintain ketogenesis. Mm-hmm. So that sort of thing is a key tool. Supplementation, you've got to be careful with for the reasons that we talked about, because depending on the treatment that the client's going through and how the oncologist will react to those things, so one has to be careful. But things like vitamin D, again, vitamin D levels, we know that vitamin D can play a very clear part in the overall sort of program for helping the client to regain control of these type of conditions. And just making sure that the body is absorbing. So going back to the digestive system, making sure that we correct imbalances in the digestive system, get rid of parasites, rebalance, use high quality probiotics, talk about histamine levels. Are histamine levels relevant or not? What about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth? If small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is present, then effectively the small intestine has got an infection, i.e. it's overgrown with bacteria that shouldn't be there. And one of the largest consequences of that is the fact that the body will not be absorbing the nutrients it needs from the foods it's eating. So you are therefore likely to have a malfunctioning immune system. And we know the immune system function is absolutely fundamental to outcomes when it comes to cancer.
Right.
So there's lots of things one can do. Reducing toxic load, looking at one's entire world. You know, watch your drinking water-wise. Don't drink from plastic bottles. You know, if you've got prostate cancer, you know, the evidence suggests, yes, testosterone, certain metabolites of testosterone possibly fueling prostate cancer, but also estrogen is the elephant in the room here. Estrogen definitely is connected with prostate cancer. So estrogen metabolism in males is really, really important here. So what about xenoestrogens? Xenoestrogens meaning toxins. So, you know, what about water from plastic bottles? What about, you know, not drinking fizzy water from plastic bottles, which is even worse? What about tinned foods, tin linings? What about till receipts? What about cosmetics? Not in men, but, you know, or maybe some men, but what I'm saying is all these things matter, because individually they're irrelevant, but actually when you join them all together, you know, i.e., you know, if you drink the wrong water and you're using the wrong personal deodorants and using the wrong toothpaste, and you live in a toxic environment because you've just repainted your walls in your house and you've just relaid the carpets on the floor and they're gassing, you know, these are all relevant.
Right. So this is rather the reverse side of the coin from what you speak about earlier, of all the positive things you can do to help somebody who's sick. These are all the negative things that added together can add up to a very bad situation.
Yes. I mean, you know, we are literally marinated in these toxins, and we need nutrients. Our bodies need optimal levels of nutrients to deal with these things, this onslaught. You know, it is, we know again through the science that these chemicals synergistically work together. They are far more damaging to us and the environment based on the synergies that they have together.
Mm.
So, you know, this is the elephant in the room often. You know, it's not something that's overt. You can't see it. It's pretty sinister, actually, because it's not, you know, we're not talking about overt pollution. Pollution used to be big pipes pumping lots of rubbish into rivers, you know, which in this country, thankfully, doesn't happen much. But this is very much under the radar. It's not something you can see. You know, when you put a deodorant on or use a deodorant under your arm, you know, under your arms, you know, you don't think of it as potentially causing a problem or adding load to the body. But it will add load to the body, and everything you put on that's not expected within the body, in fact, everything in the body has to be detoxified at some point. So, you know, obviously, if your systems are compromised, and detoxification, by the way, is fundamentally based on gut health, that is one of the key detoxification organs of the body. So going back to gut health, you know, yet again, the gut is right at the forefront of this particular subject.
Right.
One has to look at it, you know. So, if you just take another example, okay, estrogenically driven cancer. So look at estrogen-dominant breast cancer. What about imbalances in the microflora species of the digestive system? There is an enzyme called beta-glucuronidase. Well, beta-glucuronidase can be elevated. It can be measured in a stool test. If beta-glucuronidase is too high, then what we know is that beta-glucuronidase will actually contribute to hepatic recirculation of estrogens that the body is literally trying to get rid of. So, Robin, this is like me taking the rubbish out from my house to the black bin and then somebody picking up the rubbish from the black bin and putting it back in my house.
Right, right. Well, that's very well illustrated, yeah. Okay, I just wanted to nip back to you briefly explained one thing at the beginning, which I know it took me a little while to sort of cop to how amazing this is. It's this quality which is unique to natural approaches, you'll never find it with a drug, of being an adaptogen that can work in two opposite ways depending on the situation it encounters. Do you just want to say a little bit more about that, just sort of make it quite clear about how these things work?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there are a few examples of adaptogens. There are adrenal adaptogens that are often talked about. So, for example, in Ayurvedic medicine, you talk about things like ashwagandha, for example, would be classified as an adaptogenic adrenal support supplement. So it does exactly that. You know, if somebody's got adrenal dysfunction going on, then no matter whether it's over or under, you know, you would actually, you could potentially gain benefits from taking something like that. But when it comes to, again, we go back to good old mushrooms, you know, and mushrooms are a perfect example of an adaptogen. So they will literally increase immune function, which is really fundamental, of course, if somebody's going through chemotherapy, and increase immune function where it needs to be increased, so you don't end up catching lots of ailments or infections whilst you go through the process, but also suppressing an overreactive immune system. So, you know, I use this with my autoimmune clients. So obviously with autoimmunity, the immune system is dysfunctional, and often you get complete immune system dysfunction going on, i.e. the client is reacting to hundreds of foods. You know, if you just look at food sensitivity results, I mean, it's quite staggering what sometimes comes back.
Really?
And absolutely. I mean, in fact, I'm working with a client at the moment where that's exactly the case, you know, where out of 180 foods, they may be reacting to over 120 of them.
Wow. Okay.
But, you know, I mean, you can't take those foods out. It's not possible. But when that happens, when that type of response comes back, you know you've got to modulate the immune system. You've got to work out why the immune system is dysfunctional. Why is it hyperactivated? And that then leads to other things and other thought processes, such as viruses, which, by the way, are also implicated heavily with cancer. You know, one of the reasons that cancer can develop is viral load. And viral load can be latent, not an active infection, but latent infections. Things that, you know, you've had an experience before, but actually are literally just sitting there waiting to cause trouble. So there's lots of things one can do. But going back to the adaptogenic stuff, the mushrooms are a really, truly remarkable example of adaptogenic principles working, you know, whereby we don't know how it works, but we know that the immune system is raised where it needs to be and suppressed where it needs to be. And we know that through studies with organ transplants, for example, you know, where obviously, you know, organ transplants, a lot of clients take immunosuppressive drugs to stop the organ being rejected. And actually, by using certain mushrooms, the studies that are done typically in the Far East, always again, you know, yet again, show that actually this doesn't in any way jeopardize the organ being accepted by the body. So, you know, this is incredible, yet the client ends up with less ailments.
Mm. Very amazing. So anyway, that's in stark contrast to all drugs, which are kind of unidirectional. They're a bit more like Alice in Wonderland, sort of two bottles, one that makes you grow and one that makes you shrink. They'll only do the one job. They'll never have a specific reaction targeted to the actual body that they're in.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a very important point. I mean, if you look at, when you're going back to the mushrooms again, we know that with medicine, at least 40% of Western medicines utilize or based on mushrooms. We know that.
Okay.
So Taxol, which is a chemotherapy agent, you know, that's heavily used out there, comes from the mushroom kingdom. But it's a monomolecular formula. This is the key point. So it is one molecule that will confer certain effects to the recipient. Whereas, you know, with mushrooms, we know that there's roughly 150 molecules in there that confer benefits when taken as an extract, you know, at high doses. And of course, this is about everything working synergistically together. This is the whole point of nutritional science. Nothing exists in isolation. This is why double-blind placebo randomized controlled or triple-blind placebo randomized controlled trials do not work when it comes to, for example, taking vitamin C to control the common cold. It's not the appropriate model because it completely, utterly does not take into account the synergistic effects of everything working together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're getting on towards the end. And just lastly, I wanted to quickly talk about the treatment of cancer overall. It's all very well, and of course it urgently needs to improve its success rates, which are still, of course, completely dismal for many cancers. But the real need is for prevention, as we're still completely out of control of the rising statistics for cancer incidence. So this is an area where conventional medicine's got little interest, it's got little on offer, but nutritional science is contributing significantly. So would you tell us a little bit about this and the ways that you work to prevent cancer in otherwise healthy people, but notably in people who've had cancer?
Absolutely. I mean, you raise a lot of points again, Robin, you know, with that question. I mean, our system is fundamentally flawed. You know, it's fundamentally flawed. You know, we work on the principle that everything's fine until it's not.
Right.
And you know, that is a ridiculous way of running a healthcare system. You know, we got to stop people turning up at the front doors of these institutions. We can't, you know, the concept that one in two of us should develop cancer over our lives and we should accept that is ludicrous.
Yeah,
it's totally and utterly ludicrous. Yeah. Now, but when it comes to how one prevents these things or preventing reoccurrence, you know, again, lots of clients who come to me after post-cancer treatment, okay, so let's take breast cancer as an example, they get actually phenomenal attention and they get the modern medical treatments. And actually, you know, lots of clients have got lots of great things to say about how they're treated. And actually, if it's successful, then obviously they view that as a success, which is great. But often what happens is the client has all this attention and then suddenly the day that this is all so-called resolved, you're just left on your own.
Right.
And I think, you know, you fall off the edge of a cliff, metaphorically speaking. You know, you get all this attention and suddenly you got no attention. So what do you do? You know, what does one do to potentially control or reduce the chances of this ever reoccurring again? And of course, you're not given that advice. So we then use functional testing. So, for example, if you look at breast cancer, we know through again, big studies, that if it's hormonally driven, you are much more likely to develop hormonally driven cancers, so ovarian, breast, and uterine in women, and prostate in men, if you are inappropriately metabolizing estrogens. Yeah. So if your estrogen metabolism, i.e. how you break down your estrogens for detoxification processes, actually is compromised, i.e. you're not producing enough two, and this is, I'm simplifying this, but 2, 4, and 16, there are metabolites of 2, 4, and 16, but call it 2, 4, and 16. 2 is protective, and 4 and 16 are viewed as problems at too high a level. But you can do a simple urine test to measure this pie chart. So you will then know, are you in optimal ranges for 2, 4, and 16, or are you out of balance? And if you're out of balance, then you increase potentially the risk of developing these estrogenically driven cancers. Doesn't mean you will, but what it means is there's a greater chance. And that is dependent upon how you detoxify. Phase one, phase two detoxification in the liver. We can change how that functions by using certain nutraceuticals, supplements, okay, to actually enhance the production of 2 and reduce the production of 4 and 16. That's an example. So I've got a handful of clients, breast cancer clients, where we will measure that every 6 months and we just do it as a check. We obviously look at diet. We look at the whole picture. This is about, you know, making sure the body is flooded with nutrients, that their digestive systems are working properly, that they're absorbing properly, that they don't have small intestinal bacterial growth. You know, these are the things that we do to help maintain health and well-being.
Right. So there's a lot there. And of course, I mean, you've been specific there because you're talking about somebody who's had a known condition, and you will, of course, look for particular things. But many of the types of strategies actually apply to everybody in terms of staying well anyway.
Yes, I mean, the best thing that anybody can do to look after their health and well-being is to eat a non-inflammatory, nutrient-dense diet. You know, this is a whole foods diet. This is about making sensible choices about the foods you eat from a genetically congruent diet. This is a diet that our genome understands. You know, these are the foods that we've grown up with for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, not the last 10 or 12,000 years. Yeah. So it's essentially, you know, you're looking at lion caught, wild caught fish. You're talking about properly reared meat, you know, grass fed beef, you know, not corn-fed chickens and corn-fed beef, which is touted as some sort of speciality in certain restaurants, not cooking in vegetable oils. I mean, vegetable oils, my goodness me, I mean, the whole thing about heating vegetable oils and the pro-inflammatory effect that can have. Nuts and seeds, herbs and spices, water, you know, drinking water, but filtered water, reducing toxic load, exercising, meditating, cold showers, swimming, whatever it is. These are all fundamental to one's overall well-being, and each and every one of these things will have a considerable impact if you join them all together in terms of moving you towards well-being and maintaining it.
Mm. All right. Well, look, we're out of time. It's been fantastic talking to you. You're really passionate about all this stuff. And even though the oncologist may not be listening very hard, increasingly people who are sick are listening, and increasingly people who don't want to be sick are listening to these kind of messages. So that's very heartening, and I'm very pleased there are people like you out there being passionate about it and being a support to people who need it.
Well, thank you. No, I mean, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Robin, about this subject. You know, we could talk for hours about this subject, but you know, the key message I would like to sign off with is, genuinely, you are more in control than you would ever be led to believe.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Cheers, Robin.
Bye-bye.
All the best.
It's great that there are more and more highly trained practitioners like Mark in the UK, available to share their specialist knowledge and experience with people in need of support, such as those with cancer. Before the interview, Mark asked me how I knew of him, and I told him that he's one of many such practitioners in Yes to Life's online directory. You can find this comprehensive resource on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Just choose Tell Me More, and then choose the Life Directory. It's quick and simple to identify all the resources near you and to filter them down by the therapies they offer. Do take a look.
Many thanks for listening today. I hope you find it valuable, and I hope you can listen again next week. Goodbye.